Welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. Well, terrorist mastermind Osama bin Laden is back in the news again, sort of. Floundering network CNN, the least trusted name in news, embarrassed itself with a little on-air gaffe last Friday when reporting on an associate of bin Laden, Al-Qaeda terrorist Abu Zubaydah. The on-screen graphic at CNN read, "Obama bin Laden." An unforced error which earned the network a lot of social media mockery, even from liberals. As it happens, bin Laden will also be back in the news early next month when a new documentary series called American Manhunt, Osama bin Laden, that's not Obama bin Laden, but Osama bin Laden, will premiere on Netflix on March 10th. The series supposedly, we'll see because I'll watch it, supposedly will offer an in-depth look at the worldwide hunt for the evil bastard in the wake of the 9/11 attacks that he orchestrated. That'll be in March, but today I happen to have as the guest at the Right Take Podcast a former Navy SEAL who actually took part in the raid on bin Laden's compound in Pakistan back in 2011, and who actually pulled the trigger and took him out. So please stay here with us at the intersection of politics and culture. You don't want to miss this chat with the man who killed bin Laden. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the other important conversations we're having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is one of the most highly decorated combat veterans of our time. He's a legendary Navy SEAL with over 400 combat missions under his belt in everywhere from Afghanistan and Iraq to Liberia and Ukraine. He's been decorated 53 times with honors, including 2 silver stars for gallantry in action, 4 bronze stars with valor, 3 presidential unit commendations, and many more. He's a best-selling author also and co-founder of Special Operators Transition Foundation. Rob O'Neill, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Mark. I'm glad we can do this today.
Likewise. Thanks for making the time. And before I get into some other things with you, what is Special Operators Transition Foundation all about?
That's the foundation that I started when I first left the Navy because I left before retirement. In the military, you need to do 20 years to get a pension. And I did not have that. So I didn't know what I was going to do when I got out. I also didn't realize some of the skills that I had because of my service, which are being able to be a part of a team, handling stress, problem solving, being able to lead and be led. And a lot of companies seem to want that. They wanted to hear why we were successful as Navy SEALs. So when I found out I can get hired a couple different places and my skills were applicable, I started to tell other guys that wanted to get out because not everybody wants to do 20, especially when I got out in 2012, you know, we were still fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And a lot of men and women didn't want to go back. So we just started this as a way to bridge the gap between special operators and the private sector. And that's anyone from Navy SEALs, Green Berets, Rangers, a lot of pilots from the greatest aviation unit in the regiment, the TF-160 in the Army. And it got to the point where a lot of employers, and they said that they don't even necessarily need anyone with the degree. Some of these people were offering, they bring the skill set. They'll teach them. They have the attributes that they'll teach them what they need to know on the job. And I have yet to have anyone not say this is the greatest employee that I have. So that's SOTF.org, I believe. And yeah, we're still running now. We've got some really good guys running that crew right now. We started it back in, it was called Your Grateful Nation, I think, in 2014, 15, and then it's going well. So that's anything we can do to help veterans, because you know it's a world full of contingencies, and you never know what might happen. So we've got men and women out there right now ready to answer the call.
Excellent. That sounds like a great service. Well, how can people get involved with that charity? Do they just go to the website and go from there?
Yep, SOTF.org. I'm going to confirm that right now. I'm sure that's what it is. SOTF.org. Yes. and once you get there too, you're gonna see it's got a great way to get involved, how it works, who they are, who we are, and then testimonials, people who have been through it. So it's pretty cool.
Fantastic. You've also got a podcast of your own called The Operator, which people need to check out. Tell us something about that. What do you talk about?
The Operator is a fun podcast because I consider anyone who's doing anything to help themselves, their family, their community, their country. If you're doing anything, you're an operator. I was a special operator. So what I do is I give my opinion on certain things. It could be stories from the past or current events. I give my opinion as an operator, and then I ask for my listeners to give their opinion in the comments or some of the stories and reels and whatnot. And then when I read them, I read the comments carefully because if I'm wrong, I'll admit it. And I don't have a problem with that because I don't think you learn from being the smartest man in the room. You usually learn from loss, or you learn from debates, I guess. And a lot of people don't do that. You see the echo chambers on Capitol Hill. You see them everywhere. People just surrounded by yes men. Here on the Operator Podcast, the nice thing is I get to speak. I do interview guests, but sometimes I just speak so I can yell at the camera and then I take input later. But it's about everything. The Operator Podcast is available everywhere you find podcasts. And it's just a good time. I'm a big believer in keep it simple and never lose your sense of humor. So I like to think it's pretty fun.
It is. I've checked it out and I recommend it to people. So it's, there are a lot of podcasts out there and way too many, in fact. But that's one I recommend. Tell us about how you became a Navy SEAL in the first place, because you started off with ambitions for pro basketball, right?
Well, yeah, it was obviously younger, it was pro basketball. And then when you start to realize that pro athletes are, they're born with a lot more talent than most of us. So it turned into, I want to play in college. I wanted to pay for college. And then I want to get an MBA and I want to work with my father. And he was my workout buddy. As long as I can remember, he played at the University of Montana. He and I played every single day, and I wanted to play in college, and that was going fine. We had a great great one-on-one career. I had a great high school career, and then I played 1 year of college, and it turned into one of those things that I think we all go through where it's, I just need to get out of here. It's time, and I've seen that too. After I joined the Navy, I was in Butte, Montana, and I figured that, I thought, you know, living in a bubble, that was the last best place. But when I started to travel the country, I remember talking to a dude in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and one day he said, I just got to get out of here. And people in New York, I just got to get out of here. So I was at that moment in life, and the easiest way to get out of Montana was to join the Marine Corps. So on a whim, because we had just wrapped up my freshman year for basketball, and I went down to join the Marine Corps. I knew I could, and this is for anybody too, any young man or woman, if you're of an age, they'll take you. If you're down in the dumps, man, they'll take you away. You get three hots and a cot every day. You got a place to sleep. It might suck for a while, but you're going to get some skills. So I went to the Marine recruiting office in Butte, Montana. And that's when I learned that sometimes it's better to be lucky than it is to be good. Because as luck would have it, the Marine recruiter wasn't there. He was out to lunch and the Navy guy was. And the only reason I went into his office, there was four offices. The only reason I went into the Navy guy is because I had some Marines once tell me a joke that the Marine Corps is actually part of the Department of the Navy. It's just the men's department. So I walked into there to ask him, where's the Marine? If anybody knows, you will. And he said, why do you want the Marine? I said, well, because I want to be a sniper. You know, I grew up hunting in Montana, and Marines have the best snipers in the world. And he said, look no further. We have snipers in the Navy. And he said, you got to become a Navy SEAL first. No big deal. And he kind of brushed over that. And I signed a contract not knowing what a SEAL was and not knowing how to swim. And it was funny because I was standing in front of him naive, but I'm like, you know what? I don't really know what I'm getting into, but this guy's a professional recruiter. Why is he going to lie to me?
Exactly. But in retrospect, I don't think that was a fluke that that the Marine recruiter happened to be out. I think it was destiny. Do you think so too?
Well, I think so for a number of reasons, one of which is the butterfly effect. Any decision that you make, good or bad, in 30 years is going to drastically alter the course of your life. And I have four daughters, and I told them that if that Marine recruiter was not at lunch, if he was not at Arby's on a Wednesday at noon, you wouldn't be alive, because I would have gone to the Marine Corps and gone to North Carolina and not Virginia, wouldn't have met your mom, and that's that. So yeah, I like to think there was a little bit of intervention, divine intervention, whatever you call it. But I don't think there's a lot of luck anywhere. I think it's one of those things where if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plan.
Exactly. I can vouch for that. Speaking of that, are you a religious guy? I know you're Catholic, right? You grew up Catholic.
I grew up Catholic, and I've found it again. It's very refreshing for me now that I have a parish that I can go to. And it's, if nothing else, it used to be, an hour where you can listen and meditate and pray. And now that my daughter Valor's here, it all depends on her attitude because she goes with us. But yeah, I love to go to there, and I think it's important to have a community to get together, but also your faith is personal and it is between you and God. And I like it. I'm reading the Bible. I'm trying to learn some prayers in Latin. I'm trying to learn the Hail Mary in Latin, and it's funny. I had a priest say, I told him I was very proud of myself learning the Hail Mary in Latin, and he said, "Well, just make sure you say every word right, because you don't want to be practicing at 3 a.m. and you say something wrong in Latin, all of a sudden something you don't want shows up in the dark."
You've summoned up a demon or something.
It's so funny to think that way, but it's good. It's, you know, it just expands everything. I think it's healthy. Nothing wrong with, especially just the community. It's like if you're battling anything, anxiety, depression, whatever, getting outside is important. Getting with other people and just talking is important. And church is one of those things too. It's and if you're lucky, I mean, if you're in the South, you can go to church and then everybody go to Waffle House.
Yeah, I totally agree that the community part of it is important too. And for what it's worth, I can say the Our Father in Latin.
Good. I'm not there yet.
I grew up in Arkansas as a Baptist. But I went to a Catholic high school and learned Latin. And then actually I did some Latin in college too, for reasons that we don't need to go into here. But I can. And now I'm heading toward becoming Catholic. My wife's Catholic. And I got away from my faith for a long time, but now I'm getting back to it. And I can still do that. Our Father and, you know, Pater Noster, Quies in Caelis, and so on.
One of my daughters is a linguist. She speaks 3 languages and she's now studying Latin. And she said, even if it's not being used, it's important to just know your history, and you can learn other languages based on Latin.
So definitely.
Yeah. It's really cool.
Yeah. Okay. Rob, I know you have told this story a million times, but I can't let you get out of here without you telling my listeners about the Bin Laden raid.
Yeah, that was, it was at a point in our lives. We'd been fighting obviously since 9/11, and this is 2011. And we hadn't, I mean, it would even become, I was a battlefield interrogator in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I would jokingly ask terrorists that I arrested, you know, I'd ask them, blah, 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 where are you from? Who's the man of the house? Where's Osama bin Laden? And they would laugh and I would laugh because he's a ghost. We're never going to find him. But we were going to war so much there, Iraq and Afghanistan. This team of mine, we became really, really good at the job. And on the way, we did other things. I was involved with the rescue of the lone survivor, Marcus Luttrell, in 2005. I was a lead jumper out of the plane to rescue Captain Richard Phillips in 2009. And this is the same team. And so we just finished, I don't know what number deployment this was, in early of 2011. Then we were on training trips to gear up for the next one. And they called some senior guys back from, you know, we travel and train all over the country. They pulled some senior guys back to Virginia Beach, to our command. And they brought us into a room and said, all right, we found, this is not a drill, this is real. We found a thing. This thing is in a house. This house is in a bowl in the country in between these mountains. And you guys are going to go get this thing and bring it back to us and show us. And we're like, cool. What's the thing? Well, we can't tell you. Okay. What's the country? Can't tell you. All right. How are we getting there? Can't tell you. How much air support we got? None. Okay, that's finally an answer. Good. We get no air support. And they wouldn't tell us what it was. We assumed it was Libya because the Arab Spring was happening where, allegedly the locals were rising up against Gaddafi. Obviously, there's some USA interference, which is an entirely different conversation that will be coming out now that the Department of Government Efficiency is around. We assumed we're going to fly there off a flat top in an Osprey, which is a helicopter plane hybrid that doesn't have a great track record. That's why they're not telling us. We were gearing up. It was odd because they wouldn't let us bring Air Force guys, which are our like the CCT guys, the guys that run the radio for the Air Force, are the most dangerous men you've never heard of. They coordinate all our air support. The PJs are our surgeons that go with us, and they're both shooters. So the combat control and the PJs, we can't bring them because we're trying to save weight. And we just need shooters. Not that they're not shooters, but that's just extra weight we don't need. We're getting ready for that. They finally drive us to a spot a week later. And that's when we met the Bin Laden team from the CIA. And the commanding officer of SEAL Team 6 got in front of us and to the whole group and said, all right, the reason you guys are here is this is as close as we've ever been to Osama bin Laden. And we heard it. That's the first time we'd heard that name that serious, as close as we've ever been. And I looked around the room and guys were just, they weren't high-fiving or anything. Guys are just like, cool, are we going right now? Because we were ready. And then we trained up a couple of weeks to show the powers that be what we could do. There were different options, but we were one of them. Then they sent us overseas. It came down to us, and it went up to Admiral Bill McCraven, who's the finest officer with whom I've ever served. He was running the show. He sold it to President Obama, and it was a big call. I mean, this is a Desert One moment where if we screw this up, I mean, not that politics should matter, but if we screw this up, everyone's going to get fired up to the president, not reelected, I guess. So we went over there. We did get the green light. We launched on a Sunday, and it was one of those things where we're in these new helicopters that the pilots have only been flying for about 6 days. We don't know if the technology works. The president just found out about them. 90-minute flight in, we could get shot down. There's going to be a gunfight. When we get there, if anyone's going to blow himself up, it's Bin Laden, kill all of us and his family in the same building, and we're going to run out of fuel and end up fighting it out with the Pakistan police or military. This is a one-way mission. We accepted the fact that we're probably not coming back. But we did it because that's what we came for, and this is the answer to 9/11. And I mean, because we talked about the potential of death and what's probably going to happen, and we know that, but this is it. And I mean, what an ending to a story, not to get morbid. But yeah, so we had a 90-minute flight in on these quiet helicopters, and for 90 minutes, worrying, like if you're worrying about something that your worry won't affect, you're wasting your energy, stop worrying about it. So worrying about a missile hitting us isn't going to stop it. So I wasn't worrying. I was counting. I was sitting on a folding hunting chair, counting from 0 to 1,000, 1,000 to 0, 0 to 1,000, 1,000 to 0, looking around, seeing what other guys on the bird are doing. And, you know, some guys actually fell asleep, which I thought was crazy. Like, you were literally asleep on the ride to Osama bin Laden's house. Crazy. Ice in your veins. I had the dog, Cairo, who's next to me, our Belgian Malinois, his handler, Will Chesney, Cheese, was on there. And then, we banked to the south. The air crew guy opened the door, which is awesome because people never talk about the air crew. We always talk about the cogs in the machine and how everyone's part of the team. But the crew chief's job was to keep the bird flying and open the door. And that sounds simple. But imagine if we landed and none of us could figure out how to open the door. So seriously, and we're just stuck in helicopters. But if we got shot down, his family would miss him just as much as us. So he's a hero. The pilots are heroes. So they opened the door. We looked out, 2 minutes out there. It wasn't a training area. There was lights. And it's like Abbottabad, Pakistan is a resort town. And the last thing I was thinking on the way in, I mean, it wasn't nervous. We'd done this so many times. And we weren't getting shot down. So we're going to get on the ground. And my sort of arrogant, almost smirking thought was, this is some serious Navy SEAL shit we're about to do. And then the perfect plan came. I mean, the only time the perfect plan lists is when you're planning. Once you go to do your job, I don't care what it is, something changes. There's variables that come out of nowhere, Murphy's Law. And I was in the second helicopter. We were supposed to drop some snipers, the dog, and an interpreter outside the 20-foot walls. My team was going to the rooftop. While this was happening, the other team was going to hover in front of Bin Laden's house, put guys out of two fast ropes. They were going to go to the ground floor. My team was going to go from the roof to the balcony. We're going to hit them top and bottom. But the first helicopter had a crash land before we even knew it because new birds, different layout. I guess the fences were made of, they were mud walls instead of the chain link fences we were training on. It was a little bit warmer, which affects the lift. And the pilot decided he said we had the four best pilots in the world, which was awesome. And he said in the blink of an eye, if I try to power this up, we're going to roll. I'm going to put it down upside down. I'm going to kill everybody. But if I can pin the tail to that wall and stick the nose in the dirt, we might live. He made that decision and, a blink of an eye, did that. And then that, all of a sudden, that entire team's on the ground inside the compound. And so is the helicopter. So they let my guys out. We were going up, and the pilot, instead of going to the rooftop, he just went right back to the ground. And he was just saying, get out. So we got out right there. And because we were prepared, and this is why preparation is way more important than planning. We were outside, but we knew exactly where to go. We knew there was off to our left, there was a double door in that wall. So we walked over, put a 7-foot charge of C6, which is huge. That's like a master key. It'll open anything. Blasted that double door and it opened, but there was a brick wall behind it. And so that was odd. And the guy that planted the charge looked back and said, failed breach. This is bad. And I said, no, this is good. That's a fake door. Nobody does that. He's in there. Then we didn't know that other helicopter had crash landed. So there was a door off to our right now on the other side of, it was still on the same fence on the north end, but we knew that one opened because cars had come in and out. So we went over and came over the radio and told the team hey, we're going to blast the carport. Because we heard them saying Dash 1 going around. Because we thought they took fire. But what they were saying was Dash 1 going down. So I said something. I said, Donna, we'll just open it. And the door opened before I could say anything. And the thumb came out with a glove that I recognized. And then I thought, okay, that's my team. I don't know how they got in there, but it doesn't matter. They're just there. And that's a very important life lesson. Sometimes it doesn't matter why you're here. You just are. When I talk to pro football teams, I'll tell them to the offense, it doesn't matter why it's 2nd and 15. It just is. What are you going to do about it? What we all have in common in life is the clock is ticking. What are you going to do about it now? So we went in the house. My team was there. I assumed something. There was already a gunfight going on. We went in Bin Laden's house on the first floor, and there's a long hallway. Because of where we were let off, my guys were already in front of me. So I just had basically a front row seat to this mission to watch my guys do stuff. And I was down there, and I was just proud of my guys, because if this house blows up, we're all going to die. But that didn't stop anyone. No one was afraid. They were doing their job, slow as smooth, smooth as fast, breaching, you know, from like kicking the door, mechanical, explosive, trying to get in. We did get to the stairwell. We ran into Khalid Bin Laden, the guy in front. We were quiet. The key to this was we were quiet. You'll see stuff on TV or on movies where guys are screaming, go, 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 and yelling.
Right.
Like, just why aren't you yelling, here we are? Just shut up. If someone's putting a bomb on a door and they scream, fire in the hole, you don't need to. If I see you putting a bomb on the door, I'm going to assume you're going to blow it up. I'll just keep quiet. So we got up there. We were quiet. Khalid got confused because the front guy actually said something to him that confused him. He exposed himself with a gun. He was killed. And then we went up to the second floor. I was about 7 guys back on the stairwell. When we got to the second floor, the guys in front of me peeled off to the left and right because there's other doors, other rooms, other hallways, unknown people. And you don't want to start escalating before you finish the level that you're on. So they did that, and it was down to 2 of us, the guy in front of me and then me. His job was to point up to our next level. There was one more set of stairs right in front of us, and there was a curtain at the top. My job as the number 2 man was to put a hand on him, either his shoulder or his leg, not to control him, just to let him know he has a guy there. And then my job is to turn around and wait for more. I wanted more guys. I wanted at least 2. I wanted 4. I'll take 2. No one was coming. We were spread thin. And the guy in front of me started saying something along the lines, hey, we got to go. We got to go. It's time. We got to go. Because what he was seeing through that curtain up the top of the stairs, it was backlit. And he could see people moving. He was assuming those were the suicide bombers. And he was saying, we got to go because that's them, but we can beat them, but we got to go now. And I had my hand on his shoulder. We didn't have enough. And it wasn't bravery for me. I wasn't being brave. I before I squeezed him, I was just thinking, okay, we're going to blow up now, and I'm just tired of thinking about it. Let's get this over with. And so I squeezed him. He went up to the top, and he moved that curtain. And he saw, I think, 2 people. He assumed they were the suicide bombers, so he jumped on them. He tackled them and jumped on them. As if to take the blast. Like, this dude sacrificed his life jumping on a grenade that just didn't go off. And because of our tactics from day one, you always guard your buddy's back, because he went left, I went right. There's Osama bin Laden standing there, 3 feet away. And his wife, Amal, was in front of him. She'd already been shot by somebody. And it was just, I remember he was skinnier than I thought. He was taller than me. And I'm 6'1", he's 6'4". And I recognized his nose. That's him. His gray was beard. I was surprised, but he's not surrendering. He's a threat. And I shot him twice in the head as he was standing up, and I shot him again on the ground. And the reason I did that, because I've heard, you know, Monday morning quarterbacks say, well, if you want to identify him, why'd you shoot him in the head? And the answer to that is because he's a suicide bomber, and you've obviously never dealt with them. All they need to do is touch their wrist together, and it blows up, and it's horrific. It's fast, and it's permanent. So you shoot him in the face, ideally the mouth. So I did that, moved the wife, and one of the human aspects was his 2-year-old son was standing there. And as a father, I looked down and just thought, you know, this kid's got nothing to do with it. So I picked him up, moved him and the wife over, put him on the bed. I killed Bin Laden at the foot of his bed, put the wife and kid there, because I knew other Navy SEALs were coming in. I didn't want them to get in the way of anything, because, you know, it gets dangerous, especially on a target like this. They were coming in. I could hear Bin Laden's last breath, and I'm standing above him. And one of my guys who came in the room came up to him and said, hey, man, you good? And I said, what do we do now? And he said, now we find the computers. We do this every night. Come on. Exploitation, sensitive fight. Let's do this. And I said, you're right. I'm back. Holy shit. And he said, his words to me were, yeah, you just killed Osama bin Laden. Your life just changed. Now get to work. And then the time that was find the intel, see if they have computers, get the files, get whatever you need. We need to body up. We need to make sure it's him. So we brought an Arabic speaker who was also a SEAL Team 6 guy, talk to the family, make sure it's them. And they were denying it was him at first. And finally they said, okay, that's him. That's Sheikh Osama. So his daughters acknowledged it. We did take DNA. We made the call for God and Country, Geronimo. And Geronimo was not his nickname. We were saying Geronimo as a code word, a pro word, meaning we are here with bin Laden. And then we said Geronimo EKIA, meaning enemy killed in action. And it wasn't, again, insulting Chief Geronimo. It was honoring Chief Geronimo. We wanted the Native warrior with us. And that was our plan. And so then it was put him in a bag, gather the stuff, and we got to leave because we wanted 32 minutes on the ground. We're in it's not even a third world nation. We're not at war with them, and we're here. The first responders are going to be cops. I do not want to kill them because they're right. You know, they're just responding. So 32 minutes, let's get out. So we'd already been there maybe 20 minutes. And we found so much intel, so much drugs, so many disk drives and hard drives and stuff that we're just gathering it. We were putting stuff in bags, body. Me and three other guys drug bin Laden's body down the stairs out front, gave him to one of the snipers. I remember looking at the snipers and said, here's your guy. And he goes, you gotta be kidding me. And the sniper I was talking to was actually the sniper who rescued Captain Phillips, which is how small this team is. Yeah, pretty awesome. And then we went back in, gathered people up. We had to blow that initial helicopter that crashed. We had to blow it up so they don't see the technology. And then we had to call in another helicopter, which was not a stealth helicopter. It was a Chinook, a 47, one of those huge school buses with two rotors. So we got to call them in. They've got other SEAL Team 6 guys on there, other pilots. They're going to come get my team. And the coolest part of that to think about is, and no one brings this up either, the Army and SEAL Team 6 rescued the Army and SEAL Team 6 on the bin Laden raid, which is awesome. Because the pilots, we had to bring them out too. So they came to get us. We got, and as we were walking out, there was a dude tweeting. He was standing maybe not even 100 yards away. It is dark and he's tweeting. I can see the phone. And his tweets are still, or his ex now, his posts are still up if you find him. And he was tweeting, why would they be running an exercise, a training exercise on a Sunday? And I remember looking at this dude, and if we were in Iraq or a hostile area and we just took a target down and there's some dude out there with his face in a phone, I'm killing him because he's going to blow something up. But I looked at this guy and I'm like, they have no idea we're here. They have no idea. So we got in the helicopter, we turned around and we left. And now we're leaving on a mission where we accepted death. But if we can live for 90 minutes, if we can fly over that border, Afghanistan, Pakistan, we get 50 years. I get to see my kids again, but we got to live for 90 minutes. That's it. So we're flying as fast as we can. The Pakistanis, the military, and the intel definitely know we're here. They're going to scramble jets because we've sold them jets. We know they have them. And we're just racing. And a helicopter against a jet's not a good fight. So again, now it's time to not worry because it's not going to stop it. So I just turned my watch on. I'm sitting next to that sniper, next to another guy from a different squadron, and I'm just, you know, counting time. And it's got to live for 90 minutes. I'm looking at my watch. It's been 10 minutes. Okay, good. And, you know, looking at other guys, it's been 20 minutes, 30 minutes. It's been 40 minutes. All right, it's been 50 minutes. Got to get to 90. It's been 60 minutes. And then I start thinking about, like, a no-hitter getting pitched at Yankee Stadium top of the seventh. You know, I'm not going to say anything, but I don't want to jinx this. It's been 70 minutes. Now it's been 80 minutes. Then the thought that came through my mind at 80 minutes was my favorite, I think the greatest sporting event in the history of this country was 1980 when Team USA Hockey played the Russians in Lake Placid. And the Russians were the greatest hockey team ever assembled. And the Americans were college kids that had absolutely no business being with this team that, like, hasn't lost since the 50s. And they should get destroyed, but now they're winning. They're up 4-3. It's the third period. You can hear the American crowd, 10, 9, 8. Seven, still nervous. We could screw this up. Five. And the pilot came over the radio as cool as ever. And that monotone voice said, all right, gentlemen, for the first time in your lives, you're going to be happy to hear this. Welcome to Afghanistan.
Wow.
Awesome.
Did you ever in your life, even as part of that raid, think that you would end up being the guy who pulled the trigger and took out Osama bin Laden.
No, I mean, we even joked about who was going to get him. I had a buddy that was on the team that we let off outside, and then we were going to go up, and I said, it's going to be weird. Like, we're going to get to the third floor. He's going to pull one of those, like, airplane emergency slides and slide right down to the alley, and you're going to get him. Stuff like that. And so, no, never. And it wasn't drawn up that way. It's just life happens around you. But, I mean, even when I first got to SEAL Team 6, I remember the first time I worked with the Army's equivalent, Delta Force. And I was almost like, it was like, cool, that's Delta Force. I wonder if I'm going to meet the guy who eventually kills bin Laden, because it's going to be Delta Force. And that's, I mean, that was it. So there, no, never a chance. And I, you know, again, with perfect plan, I didn't plan on joining the Navy, but now I'm in. I'm going to stay in for 30 years and grow a gorgeous mustache and be an instructor drinking coffee in California until I retire as a Master Chief and then kill bin Laden. And then it's like, well, he was right. Everything just changed for me.
And how did it change? What was the impact? I imagine it was both a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, it's been both. I mean, when we finished, I looked at my team and I was like, man, we are going to be best friends forever. Like, this is you can't take this away from this team. And it was the highest moment of all of us. I mean, simply just living was great because we accepted death. But now we're alive and everyone's celebrating. And we got back and there were people waiting for us because we flew directly from, you know, we flew from bin Laden's house to Jalalabad, brought his body to Bagram, where we did the, the smarter people did the analysis of his DNA, and then we gave him to the Army. They flew him out, and the story is they threw him off the ship. I wasn't there, so I don't know what to believe anymore, but I know they buried him at sea. Then we flew right home from Bagram. So when we got back, there were people waiting for us, and it was exciting. It started to get weird because Vice President Biden immediately said SEAL Team 6. And we weren't used to being in the limelight. And when we got back, we're checking emails, SEAL Team 6, SEAL Team 6, all over everywhere. So that was awkward. And then my name immediately leaked in that community because the way it worked was every SEAL, even in the house where we killed bin Laden, guys on the second and first floor, the second they found out bin Laden was dead, the first question they ask is, who got him? So my name was leaked. It was funny. I'm known for telling stories and jokes and keeping morale up. And I guess the common answer was, who got him? They said, O'Neill. And they're like, oh, we're never going to hear the end of this. but my name was leaked. And then, so we got SEALs in Virginia. They talked to SEALs in San Diego. They all talked to their buddies in D.C. We had a guy from the White House who was a SEAL call down and talked to one of my guys, say, yeah, that was your boy. We had dudes in New York. So just my name leaking out, other guys started to get uncomfortable. And then we're getting paraded around the country, going to award ceremonies. And some of these dudes do not want their names out. They were uncomfortable. It was weird. It was awkward. And, you know, we're trying to figure out how to heal with this crap. And then we lost a helicopter on August 6, 2011, Extortion 17. We had 31 Americans, most of them SEAL Team 6 guys, my friends, that we lost in one shot. And that's when morale everywhere just took a complete dump because we went from the greatest mission ever, and then planning missions to planning funerals. And that's kind of when I realized, you know what? I've had so many close calls. I'm at just under 16 years, and I really want to see my daughters get married. I'm just going to get out. And so I told, because we lost a troop full of guys, I told my command, SEAL Team 6, look, I want to go overseas one more time because we lost so many dudes. I want to backfill as a team leader in a different squadron, do another deployment overseas, and then I'm going to get out because I'm proving to you I'm not here for fame. I came in through the front door and I want to leave through the front door. And so I went overseas. I went to war, you know, and then loose lips back home started yapping. So it turned into a whatever. Long story short, the entire mission was a success because of the entire team. And then after I got back from that deployment, I was able to do some admin work and separate from the Navy. And that's part of the reason I started Special Operatives Transition Foundation, because when I was out, you know, again, no retirement, I've done a lot of combat, and I remember on my last day, I called someone at the VA, and I said, hey, what's the grace period for my children and healthcare? And they said, midnight tonight, and then you're done. And I was almost like one of those, oh, yeah, thanks for my service. Bye. And that's it.
Well, like I've read your books, and so I know you've got a million war stories that are fascinating to hear, but I'm going to bring it into the present if we could for a moment. And without getting too political, because I know you see yourself not as a Democrat or a Republican, but as an American. And I'm the same way. I'm as conservative as the day is long, but I'm not not technically a Republican. But we just moved away from a Biden administration under which the military leadership went dangerously woke and was focused on what it perceived to be the existential threats of climate change and white rage. How did you feel about all that? And how do you feel about the military's changing direction now under SecDef Pete Hegseth? And I know you know Pete, and he was actually on this podcast not too long ago. So do you think things are looking up for the military under Hegseth and Trump?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've known Pete a long, long time. And when his name came out as, I've been to the dinner with President Trump at the White House with Pete and his wife, Jen, and my wife. It's a very intimate dinner. And they said Pete Hegseth for Secretary of Defense. I'm like, no, it's got to be a misprint. I mean, I love Pete. But I know, I just didn't think it would be Pete because he does such a great job on TV. But I've been saying forever, we don't need any of these generals anymore, because when you get to a certain rank, it becomes political for your own personal career. And guys like Mark Milley, man, they're just playing the DEI game because he wants to get a job when he gets done with his fourth star, his last command. And that's the way it gets. And we need someone who's not part of the swamp. We need someone who's been on the ground in combat, which Milley was not. Hegseth was. I loved Hegseth because, you know, he played basketball at Princeton, and he was known, still is, as the hardest working man in the building. And that says something about a dude that works his ass off at a college like that just to get on the court. And that says something about his team. He knows the men. He's very, very smart. He's got a, you know, educated not only in school, but in real life. He's been to Gitmo. He's seen the worst terrorists face to face. He knows how to run a business. He knows how to run a team. He knows how to talk to. And he'll be the guy that right now, on the border, he will go up to the Border Patrol agents. He will go to Marine Corps bases, Army bases, talk to privates. Get like the senior NCOs and officers out, let the SecDef talk to them. That's what he will do. And he's a man. He's a man. He's a father. He's a great dude. He's a man of God. And this is the guy you want. He's a no-nonsense guy. And he's, you know, he's been, it's not like he's pulling the wool over anyone's eyes. If you read his book, War on the Warriors, he told us exactly what he's going to do, and that's what he's doing. So, yeah, I'm excited. And I'm excited to see it work, because this government, other than blatant corruption that we're seeing now, thank goodness, what they're horrible with is just saying, well, this is the way we've always done it, which is nonsense. So Pete's going to go in there and shake it up, just like everyone else of the appointees. So Pete's awesome. Taking that sledgehammer to DEI and all the nonsense that does need to be happening is brilliant, because my experience in the military, I mean, getting out and looking in from a civilian side of it, and white rage and DEI and transgender recruiters and racism, none of that's in there. When we went in, when I checked into boot camp in Great Lakes, Illinois, we got dudes from Butte, Montana. We got gangbangers from South California. We got dudes from Long Island and New York City, South Florida. And the only thing we had in common is we were all scared. We all had shitty haircuts and we're all scared. That's it. And it was everyone in the military sees green or blue. That's it.
Yeah, I think there's a whole new sense of enthusiasm and hope about the military, because I read that military recruitment is now at a 15-year high. And that's just in the few weeks that Trump has been in office. So,
well, I mean, that should tell you everything you need to know about politics. These are parents telling their kids, hold on, don't. And we got to see God forbid Kamala Harris gets elected. Then President Trump wins in a landslide, and then it's like, good, go. And they just cut him loose. That's what happened. And that's so refreshing for this country. And I hope China, Iran, Russia, North Korea are scared.
Let me shift gears a little bit. I don't know if you ever get asked this kind of a question, but I'd be very curious to get your take on the war on masculinity in our culture, on what some people call the masculinity crisis that young men are facing. Now, you grew up in Montana, kind of detached from big city pop culture in a way. You had a really engaged dad who took you hunting, played sports with you all the time. You grew up and had this epic military career. But there's a whole generation or two of boys and young men out there who didn't have that or anything like that, and who have been battered for so many years, I would say decades even, by a feminized culture that tells them that their very nature is toxic, that they are responsible for a rape culture, that the future is female. And so millions of these boys and young men are now gravitating towards internet gurus like Jordan Peterson, and at the opposite end of the spectrum, Andrew Tate. You seem like a much more grounded, relatable guy than either of those two guys, who represents a more, I would say, traditional masculinity, a guy who puts service over self, unlike Andrew Tate. Surely there are a ton of boys and young men out there who look up to you as someone to admire and emulate. Is that something you ever have to deal with or address or think about?
Yeah, I do once in a while. I mean, when you're talking about, like, Andrew Tate's obviously very self-serving, very successful, and he's a great fighter. When Jordan Peterson's talking, my recommendation is everyone shut up and listen, take notes. because I think he's the smartest man in most rooms he's in, whether he likes it or not. And he's a great debater too. Like, he's good with debating, and then he can just destroy people. For me, no. I mean, I think what I'm able to tell, and I think that, by the way, the femininity is mainly on like algorithms and TikTok and horrible public schools. I hope the Department of Education gets flushed down the toilet really soon too. But I mean, it's cool now to be conservative, to like Trump, and it's always been there. I mean, I belong to a couple of gyms. I go there. There are young men and women in there crushing it every day, and it's not, you know, even in the gyms, it's not the same crap where people are fighting over being influencers. There's people in there doing real things, like cops, veterans, college kids that are back on leave or on vacation. It's always been there, but this agenda for the left that's tried to weaken this entire country has been pushing nonsense on us. Like, even right now, those protesters in D.C., right now out there screaming, wearing masks about all this crap, those are all paid protesters. Those aren't real people. They're getting $50 a day to go there scream. That's why they never answer questions. They wear masks. They scream and fight, and then they're done at 5. No, it's always been there. It's good to see, and I'm glad the military is welcoming people. I mean, there was a recruiting commercial. I think it was the Navy with this girl bragging about her two moms and marching in pride parades, which, hey, you know what? Good for you. But that's not the way to recruit the military. I mean, you think Hamas or Al-Qaeda sees a girl raised by two moms and gets scared? No, they laugh at us. When Hamas sees queers for Palestine, they mock us. It's all nonsense. But we have real people there. There's always been really good. That's why I like a mid-level leadership in the military. It's always been there. The issue is with the DEI. You get to a certain level and you have to play the game. That's why a lot of really good mid-level officers, especially in my experience, lieutenants, commander, majors, got out. It's like, I can go work on Wall Street and make millions. I don't need to put up with this shit. Now they're going to stay. So yeah, I mean, it's cool to like Trump. It's cool to be in shape. The diets are getting better. It's workout apps. Like, this is real. And we have a generation that's lost in there somewhere. These Gen Zers are, I mean, that's why my foundation's so good, because a lot of people don't want to hire someone with a gender studies degree, because that should be a 2-minute class. There's a man and a woman. There you go. There's your gender studies. I like to give simple advice. I'm not going to tell people how to study or whatever, but like my advice is, it started off when someone asked me, if you could go back in time and give 15-year-old Rob O'Neill one sentence of advice, what would it be? And that advice would be, ask her out. Whoever she is, ask her out. And that morphed into, well, that's good in life. Just take the shot. And that's my favorite saying right now is, take the shot. It's like someone says, well, man, I'm applying for this promotion, but this other dude, take the shot. What if I don't get it? Well, then you're right back here with me. What if you do get it? You know, so, and when someone says, well, oh, look at that beautiful girl with that ugly dude, how'd that happen? Well, he asked. Yeah. Take the shot, man. So that's a rambling answer to your question.
No, it's good. And on a related note, let me plug your book for a minute, The Way Forward: Master Life's Toughest Battles and Create Your Lasting Legacy. Which I've read. In that, you write about how the success of your SEAL team's Bin Laden mission stemmed not from luck, but from preparation and courage and honor, patriotism and brotherhood. Those qualities all derive from the Navy SEAL code itself, but you don't have to be a Navy SEAL to look to that code and be inspired by it. I mean, why aren't we as a culture teaching all boys and young men to live by a code of honor and courage and patriotism and service and brotherhood? Imagine how that would change society if we explicitly gave boys and young men the right code to live by instead of just letting them find their own way, because otherwise too many boys are going to live by no code or the wrong code, like the code of a gang. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a lot of it has to do with how connected we all are now because of the internet. The sad truth is you can pick up a phone and see any horrible thing you want to do. And then you've got bad actors like China out there infiltrating with TikTok, which it's entertaining, but it's also espionage. It teaches Americans that men are weak, women are strong. I mean, not necessarily like that, but you're a weak man. You need to be more feminine. Hate your country because you're racist. You're the patriarchy. You're land grabbers. This is stolen land. We're the only country that teaches our kids to hate their own country, and that's through TikTok, stuff like that, and algorithms, but also because of the communists that have invaded the school system. Nikita Khrushchev said a long time, the 40s or 50s, when he was the premier of this Soviet Union, that we could be the United States without a shot just by get into their politics, their school system, and their entertainment. And they did all of that. And so you got, I mean, it started with Columbus Day. Well, you know, just remember when you celebrate Columbus Day that it was a racist white guy who took the, you know, that's, and they just, that, it's on purpose because it's a deep conversation, but it goes back to the one world government. It was a conspiracy theory up till, you know, Monday. That there are people, I mean, look at like people like the Soros family complaining there's unelected billionaires in politics. Really? Wow. It was all on purpose. And if the media's getting kicked back like they were from USAID, and they're going to say whatever. And even Nancy Pelosi has been on camera. If you tell the public the same thing over and over, no matter what it is, eventually they're going to believe it. And that's what they're doing. And even now, I mean, there's still almost half of the people screaming right now that we're losing democracy. No, a very, very sophisticated and efficient group of people came in. They're showing you the corruption. They're showing you the theft, the money they're stealing from you. And you're listening to guys like Cory Booker and Chuck Schumer. My God, that guy. I liked him better when he was a crypt keeper from Tales from the Crypt. But I mean, and it's the same names. It's like, look at all these people that are making less than $200,000 a year, but they're worth nine figures in the government. What does that tell you? It's all corruption. And it starts with dumbing down society, keeping them at just a level where, you know, they're a protected state with all the benefits, but they have enough to live, but they don't have, it's not less, just not cheap enough to make them revolt. And then don't think that's not part of a master plan. That's what it is.
No, exactly right. Rob, I know you're a big social media guy. How can people keep up with what you are up to?
Well, follow at Mchooya, Mchooyah. That's a made-up name. I wish I didn't do that, but I did it as a joke when I had two Twitter followers, and my name leaked overnight, and I ended up with 20,000 that day. I'm like, I guess I'm Mchooya. It's I'm bashing myself because it's Hooyah for seals and Mick for Irish. So Mchooya, Mchooyah. That's all over the place on Instagram, on Rumble, on Twitter. So, and you can find all my stuff there. The books, even stuff like Cameo or memorabilia. It's all right there. It's a lot of fun, and just the podcast itself is kind of like how we're talking right now. Just a lot of fun.
Rob O'Neill, thanks for coming by and being so generous with your time. Thanks for your service, too.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark. This is fun. I appreciate you giving me the time.
Listeners, don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the important conversations we are having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave a positive review. See you next time. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.